All right, welcome everyone to this session. It's nice to see people that care about some of the same stuff I do. Let's get some full disclosures out of the way at the very beginning. This is not a typical tech ed session. What? How many of you have seen me speak before anyway? Okay, so you kind of knew that already coming in, didn't you? There's no code in here and very little about technology. It's much more conceptual. It's about where we are in the industry and what we need to do about it as a development community. Full disclosure number two is the stuff I talk about in this space doesn't change as fast as technology changes. Therefore, if you've seen me speak before, you will see a few things you've probably seen before. Even though most of this session is new content, design concepts are rooted in the human brain. How quickly does the human brain change? That's on an evolutionary timescale. Therefore, the things I have to tell you don't change that much either. So just understand that you will, if you stay and you've been seeing me before, you'll see some things you've seen before along with some new content. I don't think it hurts to kind of repeat some of these concepts because they're kind of new to us as developers. So I don't know that it's necessarily such a bad thing. Let's start with a dream that I bet most of you have had at some time in your life. In this dream, you're driving a car, maybe in icy or snowy conditions, and you press the brake, and what happens? Goes to the floor, doesn't work. How many of you have had that mushy brake dream? Come on, admit it. And you know that sinking feeling that goes along with that dream. That all of a sudden, you're out of control here. You don't necessarily have the kind of ability to steer where you'd like to go. Your future at that point is uncertain. Well, let's compare that feeling to the state of software development in the Microsoft world right now. In the last 5 years, we've just seen our industry turned upside down. Waves of change have hit us. We're seeing devices that we couldn't have imagined 5 or 10 years ago. And users are expecting to use those devices pretty much throughout their lives. They expect mobility. They expect connectivity. They expect touch. They expect our user interfaces to meet the kind of quality bar that they're accustomed to in the other devices that they use. In other words, users are now conditioned to expect modern apps. So, looking at this and understanding the changes that we're up against and knowing that virtually none of our business software is ready for this, how many of you have looked at this wave of change and felt that same sort of sinking out of control feeling about where your own software is going? Hands, please. Okay, now look around the room. See, you're not alone. There's a reason that you feel that way. Because the ecosystem has some new predators in it. So you are descended from people who had to worry about predators. Your brain is programmed to, when things get uncertain, you start to feel that feeling that I have to examine the path ahead of me and maybe alter my path. And sometimes it's just an intuition. You don't know exactly why you feel it. It's just that that uncertainty gives you the drive to worry that there are predators out there that you have to worry about that. So it's that unease is a signal that the path ahead might be dangerous or risky, and you might need to look at a different one. Now, what that means is for a lot of you, we're entering a time of the greatest challenge in your careers. We are entering the modern apps era, and today I want to talk some about how to navigate that change. Now, what I have to tell you here is based on my experience. I want to really stress this. This is not hypothetical. For the last 5 years or so, I have worked in this space. My team produced some of the earliest WPF apps that would be considered part of the modern apps era. I've helped teams from small to Fortune 1000 companies make the change from what they do now to applications that their users consider to be a quantum leap beyond the corporate apps they had before, I've worked with real teams. This is based on that experience. So I'm going to tell you some things you are not going to believe. I'm going to tell you things about yourself and what you're able to do that you might not believe. But I can tell you based on my experience that you can survive this transition in all probability. Almost all developers can. So I want to talk about how to navigate that space, navigate that change. I have absolutely been amazed at what some of these teams I've worked with have been able to learn and do. Now let's zero in on the part where the unease comes from. Where exactly is the risk? Look, the cloud is going to change a lot of things. But are you really worried about a transition to the cloud? Probably not. That's the routine pace of change that we normally get in this industry. I tell people, how many of you have trouble explaining to your family what you do for a living? Right? And the fact that it changes all the time. Let me tell you one way that I found to explain to my family the consistent, continuous change that happens in this industry. I tell them that it's as if you were married to someone, and every 2 years, you wake up married to somebody else. You just wake up one morning and it's, you know, some characteristics shared with your old wife, but you have a new wife now, and you just have to kind of learn to get along with that one. That's the kind of change that we work with all the time. But this is not that kind of change. The cloud is that kind of change. Yep, the cloud's a new wife. You're going to have to get used to the cloud, but you will adapt because you're used to that. No, going to the modern apps era is different. It's as if you wake up one morning and you are married to a reptilian alien. You don't even know what sex it is, okay? This is the kind of change that we're up against that happens about once a generation, once every 15 or 20 years in the industry. We see that kind of change, and that's the kind of change that we're into right now. Now, how did we get to the point of having that kind of a change? Well, let's see if we've got some sinking feeling examples that will be a part of your experience. How many of you have had an executive walk into somebody in IT or software development and put one of these devices down and say, "Why can't our stuff run on this? Hands, please." All right, you look around the room, that's a lot of folks. Did that give you that sinking mushy brakes feeling? Because the technology part you can probably figure out. Objective-C is kind of detailed, and it's takes more time than what you're used to, but you could figure that part out. Know what gives most people the sinking feeling is that they don't know how to write the kind of apps that are expected on this particular platform. And so the technology is not the scary part. You can figure that out. The problem that you're up against here has to do with emotion. People think that developers aren't emotional, don't they? Some of them. We are. We just express it differently. And we get emotionally attached to different things. Some of us are emotionally attached to technologies. So we have emotions, but our emotions tend to be different from the people around us. Let me talk to you about a meeting I was in. I was with a group of software development executives. And I asked them how many of them had iPads and iPhones? Anybody care to guess the percentage penetration among this group of about 20 IT executives in a Fortune 1000 company? Wasn't 90, it was between 75-80. That's the kind of penetration you see of those devices among those people. And I asked them how they felt about those devices. And one of the women got this, she lowered her voice, and she kind of looked a little kind of over, like, you know, like this at me and said, "Well, I feel like I have an emotional relationship with my iPad." Now, I've seen that kind of response from women before, but it was a long time ago when I looked like this. So I still remember what it's like. It's a very powerful emotion. It means that they expect certain things. Their life has changed. Something has come into their lives that they love. And they're not going to give it up easily. That's part of the challenge of Windows 8 right now, is the iPad was their first love. So we have to overcome that emotional attachment in this ecosystem if we are going to survive as the kind of developers that we'd like to be, using the kind of tools and stacks and that we would like to use. Because the deal is, we're pretty good from a technology perspective. Look, Microsoft realized that this was the problem, that this was a problem about 3 years ago. They realized it was an existential threat. They reoriented their strategies to do this operating system right here. Most of you have seen it. You get to pick up the machines that use this operating system. This operating system, from a technical perspective, is fine. It has faster development in our estimation. It's about twice as fast to develop applications on Windows 8 XAML as it is on iOS Objective-C, and we do both for our clients. It's got a lot better security and manageability. Your IT guys like that, don't they? We can plug all kinds of stuff into this that we can't plug into the iPad. They don't have USB ports on the iPad, do they? So we have some serious advantages there. We have various form factors. We go all the way up to wall-sized machines with the same sort of stack that we're doing in the tablet devices. So we have the technology. We have the ability to give them the solutions that they want. And that means that if they walk in and put that iPad down, you can make a counteroffer. You can say, well, I understand what you want, but we can give you something better and talk about many of the advantages that go with that. Because the iPad is fundamentally made for a consumption-based culture. It was designed for that culture. For business apps, we have work to do. I remember I went and got an iPad. Let me be honest about this. I hate the iPad, but it's not designed for me. I went and plunked my $600 down, same as everybody else when the first iPad came out, because I felt that I needed to understand what made that device special. And I asked people, why do you buy it? Why do you use it? In particular, the question I ask most often is, when you were standing there in the Apple store and you whipped out your credit card to buy this thing, what did you expect to do with it when you walked in the door back home? And you know what the most common answer is? I don't know. They touched it and felt it, and they had to have it. A new love had come into their life. It was at an intuitive level, not at a conscious function level. As developers, we think that's kind of silly. We wouldn't spend $600 on that for the most part. I did it for professional reasons and took it home and hated it. But they don't. They love it. But then when we start to talk about how we need to do business apps, well, it's not made for that. The culture is not made for that. I heard a guy talk about, I've heard this several times, and it just sets my teeth on edge. Oh, my grandmother loves her iPad. I'm sure she does. Your two-year-old likes her speak and spell, too. Neither of them have any work to do. This is the platform for business. This is the platform to take the kind of apps that you do and bring them into the modern apps era. But you are going to have to convince people all the way from those 80% iPad executives down to Joe in the warehouse and Sue at the desktop that you know how to write apps that are good enough to play in that world. If you cannot do that, our existence as an ecosystem is threatened. That's all there is to it. We'll be replaced by people who can if we can't write the kind of apps that people expect. And as I said at the beginning, I am completely convinced, based on actual experience with real teams, that we can do it. Are any of my clients that I've led through design, or any of you here, I haven't seen. I don't know if anybody even came to TechEd this year or not. They don't need TechEd. They got me, right? So now, I do want to get expectations straight, though, because I don't necessarily think that, as I said, you don't have to worry about the technology. We have all the UI stacks that we need. In fact, our UI stacks are better than any of the other UI stacks out there. I know, because we have to use them. And yet, using those UI stacks, the temptation for developers in this ecosystem is this is what you're attached to. This is what you're used to. And the biggest challenge I have is breaking you loose from this to come to the modern apps era, because you just can't do this anymore. You just can't. And that's a big, big step for people to make. Now, it does kind of surprise people. They look at things like this. They look at modern apps. Let's take a look at a modern app, just a couple of examples, to give an idea of how far that the world has come here. So if we look at, for example, Skyscanner is up there. Well, that's pretty, and then, you know, we press these things and we get all kinds of, we get nice visualization, we get nice interaction. It's clear that we know where we are, et cetera. It's just a fluid, easy to figure out experience. The data visualization is good. Look how easy it is to read that. How many times have you gotten an airline itinerary from an airline company in the mail and you can't read the bloody thing? You're trying to track down the time that you actually take off in that morass of text they see. No, this is the kind of visualization people expect and people need. So we can look at apps like this to get ideas about where things are going. We can also look at apps like this. Locate this before I came in, but anybody play Halo? You ever look at Halo Waypoint? This is an HTML5 application here. Now, I don't think it knows who I am yet, so let me go ahead and tell it to track, and it will probably ask who I am. I do. MouseAlive.com. Four. This is an HTML5 app. You can run this on any system that you like. Look again at the data visualization that comes up there. The ability to look at individual. Let's go back to the beginning there, at the top. I want you to notice some things about this that are characteristics of modern apps, characteristics that you need to learn are important and imitate. Look at that Spartan card over there. Notice that they overlay information. We think in terms of separating things out into rectangles on the screen, because with the technologies we've had in the past, that's pretty much what we had to do. But now we can put things on top of one another and assemble in a way that's easy for people to visualize. So my Spartan rank is layered right on top of what my current Spartan armor looks like, and my emblem is in the background. I don't have an online rank yet, so that's just dashed out. You look at the data visualization over in that list box. War games, matchmaking, how many games completed, etc. That's the kind of data visualization that we expect in the modern apps world. That is, to most of you, I think, pretty alien to the kind of development that you've done in the past, and maybe even alien to what you expect to do in the future. But I think you can do it. Now, let me explain something about expectations here. You look at that Halo app, and you look at that Skyscanner, and you realize, gosh, those guys have professional designers. They probably have some of the most talented designers in the world. How can I ever compete with that? That's not the way to look at it. As I said, in my own experience, you can compete for business apps. You don't have to be at their level. You just have to be a lot better than you are now. And the best metaphor I know of is photography. You have no doubt seen professional photographs that were amazingly good in places like National Geographic. And you realized you probably could never take those photographs. But you don't have to be at that level to go and shoot your cousin's wedding. All you need is a basic understanding of composition, a basic understanding of your equipment and what it will do, and a process to get you through it. If you've got that, then you are able to play in that world at an acceptable level. You don't have to be a superstar and all-star there. And that's what I try to communicate to the teams I work with. I want to get you to that level where what you're doing is acceptable quality in terms of people's expectations in the modern apps era. We're not trying to be award-winning designers. We're just trying to be acceptably good. And that's a lot better than you are now. But this kind of illustrates that there are basic principles involved, in this case, composition principles. In the case of modern apps, it's design principles. What makes a design good or bad? There are certain principles around that. There's the equipment, what kind of tools. We need to know our UI stats. We need to know what they're capable of. If you don't know what XAML or HTML5 is capable of doing, how can you possibly design a good and write a good application for it? And we need a process. What do we go through to get design? What kind of steps do we do? So this is a pretty good metaphor for you to keep in mind. You don't think of it as trying to write something competitive to Halo Waypoint. Just think of it as analogous to shooting your cousin's wedding, and you're going to get the principles right, you're going to get the technology right, and you're going to get the process right. This is probably a good time to stop and give people a chance to ask a question or two. In case I am unclear, right there, I will have to repeat it. What? How do you get business buy-in to put more time into design? You go read the article that I wrote in MSDN Magazine last month on Is UX Investment Worth It?, which discusses how you calculate the return on investment for user experience design. I have formulas in there. Man, but to give you a brief understanding, with modest assumptions, and we're going to talk about the way you reach some of those assumptions in a moment. With modest assumptions, user populations in the hundreds can save millions of dollars in labor costs and a lot of money in training and retention. It's a financially good investment for the majority of large companies with large user bases. All right, let's proceed then. Of course, we have some things to overcome. Some of the people in this community, why did you get in this community? I've had people come up and talk to me about this and say, Billy, I got in this business to write code. It's what I like to do. It's what I'm good at. I don't want to do anything else. That is what I call code addiction. And when I say addiction, I don't mean that lightly. Have you ever been in the room when somebody was describing a new app? And it's an hour-long meeting because there's a lot of stuff to cover. But 5 minutes into the app, you are no longer listening to the person talking to you. You are coding the solution in your head. Okay? Yeah, you're nodding your head because you know you do that. You have to get over that code addiction, but that's a matter of will. And for the most part, I feel confident that people can do it because I've seen them do it. You just have to understand that addiction is there and deal with it. You have to practice the listening skills. Practice putting the code out of your head for this part of the design process. And I know that's hard because the design process I will sketch out for you is going to start with paper and pencil. No code. So that's part of what you have to get used to. So that's one thing that tends to hold people back. Another is that they have this idea that they just can't do it. They think of designers as these flashy, colorful creatures that are just amazingly different from developers who are more like turkey vultures or something. Okay? How many of you kind of hold that mental image in your head as the difference between developers and designers? Yeah. So you've got to get past that. And the designers like it that you think that way. Oh, they love it. Because if you believe that they're essential and can do things that you'll never be able to do, then they have a lot more control over the process. And they love that. But in fact, while designers have some strong things about their background and their sensibilities, and they're great participants in the process, in particular, they're good at the visual aspects, color judgment, aesthetics, things like that. They can be very good at those things. And I love having designers as a part of my design teams. But what I've learned is, it is a rare designer indeed who will acquire the domain understanding, the business understanding, that you already have. And like it or not, the value in the modern apps era is not the cosmetics. It's not the colors. You can get that from a lot of places. The value is in interaction. Does the app make intuitive sense the first time somebody walks up to it? I tell people that if you do a good design and you put it in front of a user, the best possible response you can expect is, of course. That once they see it, they can't imagine that it would be done any other way. Now, you won't always reach that level, but that's the level that you're striving for. A level of transparency in the design that it just feels so natural, they can't imagine doing it any other way. In that case, the aesthetics are just kind of a minimum bar. If the aesthetics are bad, they'll notice. But that's not the point. The point is, does the interaction fit? Do you get that of course? And you'll never get that of course from cosmetics. Unfortunately, as I said, breaking you loose from the past is not easy. This is the world you live in. This is the world that your brain lives in. This is the way you think about things now. You put data grids on a screen because, I mean, that's flexible, isn't it? It gives the user all the data. They can sort it in any way they want. They can drag the columns around. In other words, it's a shortcut. It's a facilitator to you being lazy enough to not really find out what's important to the user from a data perspective. You find out that you could put this on there, as Errol Balkin used to say, it's basically your screen looks like the database threw up on it. And that's kind of typical for data grid-based designs. Do you realize that modern app platforms don't have a data grid in them? Windows 8 doesn't. Objective-C doesn't. You can fudge things up to act that way, but there's no native control to. Why not? Why didn't they put one in there? Because this way of interacting with information on the screen is an artifact of a mouse-driven, keyboard-driven, GUI world. In particular, if you go to touch, the cells have to get a lot bigger for the fingers to fit in them, which means that you're now going to be putting a lot less stuff on the screen. What does that mean? That means that with any reasonable amount of data, it's like looking at a map with a rolled-up tube. You just can't see very much at any one time. The data grid experience falls off very rapidly when you start to have to blow up the sizes. Now, that's bad because data grid designs depend upon the user doing visual scanning and parsing to figure things out, scanning down that column to find the thing that they want. And if it's hard to scan because there's not enough stuff on the screen at once, then the usability begins to break down. Besides that, we got better ways anyway. We've got better options for the vast majority of scenarios where you would use data grids. That doesn't mean data grids are never used, particularly in desktop scenarios. Some kinds of accounting scenarios in particular, the data grid is the obvious interaction pattern for the user. It's what they understand. They would probably not understand anything else. So I am not telling you to never use a data grid, but I am saying that it should be your last resort and not your first resort when you begin designing modern apps. The other reason that the data grid is a bad fit for the modern apps era is that your biggest target of opportunity to make your apps better is data visualization and presentation. The reason why you have such a big opportunity there is that the way people have done it in the past is that scanning technique. That requires conscious work to parse, read, interpret, to find the thing that's needed. The conscious brain has to be involved, and by the way, there's a fair fatigue factor there. But we've got better options with the technology that we have today. We can look at something like this, and that 50 out of 50 jumps out at us. If we go down a little bit further and see some of the badges down there, we can see that we've got the solo and co-op completions. The co-op is grayed out because it's not finished yet. I don't have to tell people that it means that. It's intuitively obvious when I visualize things with those kinds of symbols and colors and shading and such. Why is it intuitively obvious? Because it's using a different part of the brain than you use when you scan through data grids. And that's one of the most important things to understand about modern apps, modern app design. You ever used one of those really old junky computers with that really lousy motherboard-based graphics that you shared memory, really use the CPU for all the rendering? You've used those, right? And then you notice the amazing difference when you went to a machine that actually had a GPU on it. The GPU is optimized for things that the core processor's not. That's kind of a metaphor for how the brain works, too. The visual system does things before the information reaches the conscious level. It notices things. And because of that, you're able to put signals in that people will see almost at a subconscious level, and that means you're offloading work from the conscious brain into the visual system. And that is a powerful way to increase productivity. People notice things much, much faster. Some of the design principles involved in that kind of preconscious processing are called Gestalt principles. Gestalt principles describe how the visual system works at a very primitive level from the retina through the next stage of processing. And Gestalt principles, there are quite a few of them. Here's one, for example. Your eyes fill gaps in. Automatically. You can't help it. I know what you're all seeing. This is a mural in Italy, by the way. And in reality, it looks like this. But that is not what your eye filled in. And it was completely unconscious. You didn't go through an analytical process of saying, oh, I bet she's not wearing anything underneath those bars. No, it was almost instantaneous. It was unconscious. Your visual system did it automatically because your brain fills in gaps. That's part of the Gestalt principles. Well, that means, for example, that's why we can get away with minimalist icons. The brain will fill the gaps in. It's okay. You don't have to make the stuff you put into these designs that you do extravagantly realistic. They should be a good metaphor for what the user will think about when they're looking at the data, but you don't have to be a graphic artist to produce some of these things. Those kinds of minimalist shapes, there's libraries of them out there. They're relatively easy to adapt if you need to. So, you know, I remember when icon design first, in the realistic icon era, anybody ever have to do that? Well, that was time-consuming and messy, and you had to have a talent for it. Not so much in this world, because we've now learned that the visual system will kind of fill things in for us. You also want to learn design principles, not just study them academically, but based in what you see in the real world. Observe good and bad design in the real world. And when you see good design or you see bad design, you should be able to analyze those designs to understand what are the principles that make them good or make them bad. Yeah, that's my next slide. Let me bring it up in just a second. Let me explain to you a little test I want to do. I got a picture of a radio, stereo, that was in a rental car I had a few months back. And I'm going to show it to you for about 5 seconds. What I would like you to do is figure out how you turn it off. Now, understand that when you're driving, you don't have very long to look at a radio, do you? Therefore, it ought to be good. It ought to be fast. It ought to be intuitive as to how to turn the thing off. You ready? Here's the radio. Okay. What do you think? How do you turn it off? Power button where? Top right? Who saw the power button in the top right? Who did not see the power button in the top right? Okay. Neither did I. While I was driving down the interstate at 60 miles an hour playing rap music on the thing, and I... Because, see, I thought you'd turn it off the way you turn off any other radio. Press the button. That's what most of you probably thought, right? Nope. My wife won't buy a car unless it works that way. Because she got one of the first stereos, a Pioneer, that did that back in the 70s. From then on, that was her buying decision on a car. So why did they... We can go back to it now that you've kind of gone through the test. Yeah. Notice that button is as far from the driver as it's possible for something to be on this device. Yeah, it violates conventions. It's in a bad place, the light coming in kind of makes that, I didn't see the PWR while I was driving down the road. So that particular, if some of you may have seen this, I think this is in my plural sight course on user experience principles, which I'll talk about in a minute. So some of you may have seen this picture before, a few of you. But most those of you who haven't seen it, this is just bad design. And it's bad design for a lot of reasons. But if you begin to analyze, one of the reasons that you don't tend to notice that power button is due to a design principle called the Gutenberg diagram. The Gutenberg diagram describes how the human eye, if you are raised in a left-to-right reading culture, how the eye tends to scan rectangular surfaces. It starts in the upper left corner and tends to scan toward the lower right corner. There's a reason that save and close buttons have been down in that corner for a long, long time. There's a reason people tend to put things in the upper right, like login stuff and such, that you don't use very often, because that is out of the track of the normal way that people look at things. Therefore, one of the design principles violated by that radio is that they ignored the Gutenberg diagram. Now, it's possible, because it comes from Japan, that it's the same model they use in Japan and they didn't see anything wrong with it, because in their culture, they may very well scan the other way, and besides that, the driver's on the other side of the car. So for the person that designed this, probably thought they did a perfectly fine job. But this illustrates something I'm going to hit on in a moment, the fact that sometimes design is contextual. That design principles aren't rigid. They apply to particular circumstances. And for this particular case, in this particular car in America, that's a bad design. Some other design principles that are particularly important to developers include Fitts' Law and Hicks' Law. There's long involved explanations for what they are, but what it comes down to, Fitts' Law says it's easier to find and use big buttons. Now, this is one of those cases of you have to be careful about trade-offs, though. Especially on touch-based systems, you want to get your buttons up to a certain size in order to keep the error rates down. There's a whole bunch of stuff in the Windows 8 design guidelines about how error rates go up as the size of the thing you're pressing goes down. You may have seen that graph. So certainly you have to get up to a certain size, and large buttons for common things are easy to get to. On the other hand, if the button gets too large, it becomes subject to something I call the Fisher-Price effect. You are basically insulting your user by implying that they're a toddler who's too stupid to find anything on the screen, so you have to make it huge. So there's always trade-offs. And because of the trade-offs, when we apply design principles, we don't necessarily know whether we have it right until we start laying options out in front of the users for evaluation. We'll get to that when I talk about design process here shortly. Gestalt similarity. The visual system organizes what it sees into groups using size and shape and color and other factors. So, for example, here is a great device to take a look at, because it's designed. This is the most successful slot machine in the world. This is Wheel of Fortune. You can go down the street at Harris Casino and see one. I took this picture in Las Vegas. Notice the grouping of the buttons. First of all, notice the respect for Hicks' Law. There aren't too many options. I don't want the people sitting at my slot machine getting confused about what to do. I want them spending money. So I'm going to keep it simple. And then there are the options with the square buttons. They're kind of general operations. They're smaller. They're off to the side where the left hand is. Notice that people are normally going to be using the right hand to work with the machine. Therefore, the buttons they want to be pressed are bigger, grouped similarly, shaped similarly, and over to the right. Had you ever thought about design principles when you looked at slot machines before? You should. You should look at those, because look, those people make ridiculous amounts of money sucking it out of people. They are experts in human psychology. They know how to please people and how to keep them spending money. I do an entire session at some conferences called What Las Vegas Can Teach Us About User Experience Design. I have pictures from all over Las Vegas illustrating good and bad design principles. Mostly good, because those people do a really good job. So look at that design in the real world. I'm going to skip the exercise because of time and maybe come back to it if we have time at the end. Another general principle for design principle is that users like white space and less crowded screens. It's actually, there are several design principles that play into that. One of them is called inattentional blindness. Have you seen the videos where, well, there's one, for example, where they have a guy bringing up random pedestrians to help him with a map. And then while that's happening, some of his associates go between them with a door, carrying a door. And one of the guys carrying the door swaps places with the person that asked for help. How many of you have seen these videos? They're hilarious, aren't they? It's amazing what people don't notice. Most of the time, they don't realize the person has changed on them. You can change the age, you can change the race, you can change the sex, and still a majority of people won't notice that it's a different person because their brain at that point in time is focused on that map. And it's screening out the other stuff. So understanding inattentional blindness, there's also a famous video that some of you have seen in sessions I've done with the basketball teams. I'm not going to tell you about that one. Just go out and look for it. You'll find it. Watch it. Take the test. There's also the Savanna principle, the idea that people like open spaces. Open spaces tend to make them feel more relaxed. It's built into our brains. Openness means safety. Openness means there's not a lot of things I have to keep track of. It's less stressful. So people tend to like things that are not cluttered, that and that connote safety. That's the reason we have big front yards. Front yards are useless. I know, because I have to mow this one all the time. It's useless. We never use it for anything. The only person who's ever on it is me in the lawnmower. And yet it makes my property value substantially higher. There's a 100-foot setback rule in my neighborhood. So that makes the property more valuable because people like the idea that they look out their window and there's this nice big buffer between them and that guy walking his dog down the street. It just feels better. This one's from Las Vegas. That's a plaza. Why do cities have these big open plazas? Because people like them. Psychologically, they like them. And then there is horror vacui. This is what you guys sometimes suffer from. Fear of empty spaces. The idea that I have to put something into every square centimeter of that screen. Screen real estate is valuable. You heard that one? Well, at one time it was. At one time, swapping screens out was a laborious, slow deal. You had to put the stuff the users needed there because you couldn't take the response time to keep swapping stuff out. But we are past that now. In the modern apps world, we've got as much real estate as we want. We can just keep adding more real estate at the end. Screen real estate is no longer valuable. Pixels are free. And yet, that's one of the hard things for you to break loose from because you've always written apps with this idea that I have to put everything on the screen, and your users probably demand that you do that. They demand it for a reason. Because they figure if you put it out of their sight, they'll never find it. They're convinced that you don't understand their jobs well enough to show them just what they need and to get the other stuff up there when they need that. They don't believe you know your job well enough, so they're convinced, I gotta have it all there or I'll never find it. Therefore, one of your jobs is, in the modern apps era, is to put things in front of users that feel so right in terms of presenting the right information to them, that they lose this idea that they have to see everything. Now, that's possible. But if you talk to your users, they'll tell you every time, put it all on the screen. Almost every time. Because that's what they're used to now. And understand that from some of their points of view, for some of those users, that's probably in their own self-interest. I mean, they already know where everything is. They had to go through this nasty training. And they're slower than they could be, but that's okay. They're still collecting a check. But all that complexity means that there's a barrier to entry for new people coming in. Well, they kind of like that, don't they? They don't want the app to be so obvious and intuitive that any Joe can walk in off the street and take their job. So the users are not necessarily going to guide you to the right place in the modern apps era. You need design principles to help understand. Users' feedback is very important. The users are a huge resource in everything we do, but we don't necessarily do everything they tell us to do because sometimes we know the design principles dictate that we should do something else. Oops, yeah, let's go back. So I do this test. Some of you have probably seen this test to kind of explain to you why it's really kind of bad to crowd things up. I got two pictures I want to show taken at the Mall of America of shop windows. And I want you to just glance at them quickly and decide which one you think is a shop with expensive goods and which one is a shop with cheap goods. So here's number one, and here's number two. Okay, which one's expensive, which one's cheap? First one looks expensive, doesn't it? Now understand, the Mall of America is in Minneapolis, Minnesota, retail capital of the United States. There are some savvy retail people there. That's, I think, still the biggest mall in the continental USA. So if these people do something, it's for a reason. And I went through Mall of America looking at shop windows, and this is what I saw. Even the Lego store, a very open shop window. Now understand, retail real estate is expensive. It costs a lot of money to put that thing there, and they still leave it uncrowded. So your screen real estate expensive thing isn't making much impression on me when compared to real estate, people are still going with openness. It got to the point where even the mannequins were saying, do not put anything else in here. So understand that there are psychological implications when you make things crowded. If people are used to crowded, they may be okay with it, but in the modern apps era, we can do better. And it's our responsibility to do better and not to just slavishly kind of do what they want. Now, I mentioned before about context-sensitive design, that design principles are not hard and fast rules. Sometimes they trade off against one another, so you have to depend on context. I want to show you another picture from Las Vegas, a couple of hotels side by side. These hotels look about as different as it's possible to look. I want you to decide which one appeals to you, and then let's talk about why they did it the way that they did. Okay, got your decision in your head there. Now, the one on the left, the Aria, has a beautifully curved design and expresses very well a design principle called contour bias. That curved shapes are associated with safety in general, and that sharp shapes are associated with danger. So a lot of people tend to somehow feel better about the Aria because it has that nice flowing design. Well, in that case, why did the Cosmopolitan make their outer shape look like that? That looks like a fort, man. Well, the Cosmopolitan, now understand here, I have never talked to the designers and architects of the Cosmopolitan, so I don't know why they did it. But it was a useful exercise to me to try to figure out why they did it and understand what was the motivation. It is my opinion, this is my hypothesis, that the difference is the kind of clientele that they're trying to attract. The Cosmopolitan is very upscale. Where do those people typically live? Somewhere in a compound or gated community or something with those sharp spikes on the fences. For certain people, that kind of appearance means when I get inside, I'm safe. It's protected against the riffraff. But there's almost a psychological, but they have to be used to that, you see. They have to be used to driving through those gates with the sharp spikes, and then when they get inside, they relax. Well, I think that's the case because when you get inside the Cosmopolitan in the bar, you see this. So they play up the contrast of let's block off the outside, but when you get inside, it feels nice and curvy and natural and safe. Now, I don't know that that's what the designers were thinking, but it is my opinion that some kind of thought process like that led to what they did. To learn design principles, there are several resources that you can use. I've hit a few of the major ones, but there are over 100 of them, and the book Universal Principles of Design talks about them. Not all apply to software, but many of them do. In terms of the Gestalt principles, that visual system doing things automatically, that is more a function of neurobiology and designing with the mind in mind. Talks about that. So let me show you a quick example. Something that kind of inspired by what was in the book there. I've got to go to that, don't I? Yeah. Hello. All right. So you saw that Halo Waypoint thing with a lot of visualization stuff in it. Some of it is from Gestalt principles. That's not everything, though. Let's this is an example I did for a conference a while back in which I'm using... Oh, I forgot to take that line. I thought I took that line out, but apparently I didn't. So imagine some visualization that kind of looks like this, that there is a customer satisfaction index of some kind, that if I hover over this thing, we'll actually see it, that this one is 33, this one is higher, it's 83, this one is minus 56. Now, I could just put the number up there, but that would require conscious parsing to kind of understand exactly where this customer is in terms of my satisfaction scale. But the brain is optimized to interpret faces. You might look at this and go, well, that's kind of cheesy, isn't it? I mean, smiley faces and frowny faces? Well, that's what the brain is optimized to see. Therefore, a user can, at an almost subconscious level, look at visualization like that and go, oh yeah, they're not happy. But they're not too unhappy. And that's really all that they need, and they don't have to think very much about it. And then you can do overlays. You can see I've got the little top 10 thing layered right on top of that, meaning that particular customer is top 10 in terms of revenue. Did I get the... Do I have the... Yeah, this is a top 10 revenue customer. And then how many days has it been since I talked to them last? Maybe that is one of the key things that a user needs to see at this point in the interaction flow. Therefore, I'm going to show that to them if that's important to them. Furthermore, when I expose it to them, I'm going to not just say 147 days. If it's more than a couple of months, I'll probably say 4 or 5 months. And if it gets up into years, I'll put it as years. That way, it parses naturally to what the user needs instead of it being some time span the way the database is. Because in the database, I don't have 22 days. In the database, what I've got is the last time I talked to them, which is a date. So I have to turn that into something that the user naturally parses. I could very easily just put up, here's the last date that we talked to them. But now the user has to consciously look at that, do the arithmetic, roughly, to figure out how far back that was. I don't want the user to have to do that. So it's about helping people not think, and as I said, one of the ways is that you put things on there that are very, very quickly understood by the user, like that smiley face. And that sort of information is discussed a lot in that book, Designing with the Mind in Mind. So, almost forgot a few things about design principles. Some of you may have seen, I have a course on Pluralsight that spends about 4.5 hours going through some of these design principles with a lot of visualization from the real world as well as examples in software. If you don't have a Pluralsight subscription, you can trot down to the exhibit floor. They'll give you a trial for a month. They'll give you a card for a month. You can go look at that, and I think it's probably about as painless an introduction to the most important principles for developers that you'll likely to see. One guy read it and called it Discovery Channel for Developers. Who's seen the course? Is that a pretty good description? Discovery Channel for Developers? And then there are on-site courses from various experts. There's not as big along a list as I'd like there that teaches this stuff. Some design people don't teach principles, they just teach process. Process is important though. So let's spend some time toward the end here talking about the design process that you'll need. Knowing principles is not enough. You must learn the principles, and you also need, in the course of learning the principles, to gather this library in your head of things that you've seen that work and don't work. A lot of people, by the way, like to carry around a notebook to do that. I've got one right here that's my favorite kind, if I can find where I put it. It's a Moleskine, and I've put it somewhere. It's a little black notebook that's unlined. And I like unlined design notebooks because that kind of facilitates some of the sketching that you would do. So some people carry a notebook around for, I knew one guy carried around for 2 years and just saw things in the real world, sketched ideas, saw things in software, entered interesting things that he saw, good designs, so that he would have a library of things when he entered the process. The purpose of the design principles is to help you come up with good designs and to evaluate designs to know whether or not they are good or bad. But that design capability, those design principles, fit into a design process that goes through certain stages in order to go from understanding what the user needs all the way to a finished prototype that you hand to a development team to implement. And there's various stages in between. There are lots and lots of ways of doing design process. I am not dogmatic about how you do it because there are so many different possibilities. There are certain principles, though, that I highly recommend. You can pick and choose the details, but the keys for design process from my perspective is, number one, it will be experimental. What I mean by that is there will be competing designs. You will do more than one design to compare against one another. Some people like A-B testing. Now with me, it's 3, 4, 5 designs. As many good ones as I can come up with to compete with one another. It is collaborative. There are various people, various stakeholders involved to give us feedback, including users. It's iterative. We continue to refine it over time, and it starts with paper. I know. They put a wireframing tool in Visual Studio. I know that. Every time I say this, somebody says, we can use a wireframing tool in Visual Studio now. Please don't do that at the first. You can get to it later, especially if you've got to do things that you've got to share across the internet. But when you sit down and you want to create new things, to come up with new designs, paper and pencil, pen if you must, I prefer pencil. Paper and pencil is going to give you a lot more freedom to do things than any tool that you have. See, if you sit down in front of a tool, you will constrain your brain to things you already know how to make the tool do. Therefore, your brain will just automatically chop off various avenues of discovery. So start with paper and pencil. Give it a try. In essence, in fact, I think that for me anyway, when I get out the paper and pencil at this point in time, it's now a design ritual for me that tells my brain, it's a signal to my brain, you are not writing code, you are not drawing screens, you are coming up with design. And so I strongly urge that. Now the general process looks like this. You go through an understanding phase. Usually that involves understanding a lot about what the user needs, what the work models are, but it also involves looking at the users in the field. And then a design phase where you use storyboarding, paper mock-up, illustration, and interaction prototyping. Contextual inquiry. Observing users in the field, doing real work, with their environment. Sometimes you need a camera to say, well, this is what we've got to deal with in the environment. Look, this person uses tons of sticky notes. That's not right. Or I'm in the warehouse. Where's the guy going to put the tablet down in order to do X? So I need the environment as well as what the user is doing. And I need an interpretation phase to understand and access what was learned, which might lead to another round of contextual inquiry. This typically takes days. 2 days is typical. For a complex system, maybe 3. And my attitude about this is, how many of you have gone and sat with your users for 3 days in the past 3 years? Oh, that's not many. If you can spend 5 years honing your craft, as the software craftsmen tell you, can't you find 3 days to go watch the users? You'd be amazed at what you learn. I go in to new clients all the time, and one of the first things I hear is, hey, we've done all that, and here's the notebook that's got everything. We have business analysts for that. So all the requirements, it's all here, all the test flows. You don't need to go talk to the users. How many of you have been up against that when you asked to go? Yeah. I don't know what you do. I have the liberty of saying, well, I'm going to talk to the users, or I'm not going to do any work for you, because it's impossible for me to do a good design without being able to put myself in the user's head. It's not possible. Therefore, I will read your books and find out probably useful things, but in every single case, there are things missing. That person has put their own cast on it. And too often, that cast is tied to the past. It's the way they've always looked at it, and they haven't opened up to the possibility of looking at it in new ways. Then we get into storyboarding. And that's just at the level of matchstick drawings, basically. Very, very simple. What screens do we need, and what are kind of some of the major things on them? Look, you don't have to be an artist to do the kind of stuff that you need to do here. Where's that thing that I gathered? I picked this up on the way in, one of the doors. I'm going to put it back. I don't need these bags, but you see these coming in the door? There's the directions on how to use it. Stick figures. There's nothing to it. The funniest comic on the web, in my opinion, is XKCD. And it's nothing but a bunch of stick figures. So no, I'm not telling you to go out and become artists in order to do storyboards. I'm telling you to do things at a stick figure level of quality in order to get the basic idea down on paper before you go to the screen and start doing wireframes and illustrations, etc. Now, the first time through this process is the hardest, because there are several things you tend to do wrong. One of them is that you're tempted to think small. You're tempted to think, well, you don't have the confidence that you know how to write modern apps, so you write something that's a whole lot like what they have now, except with some refinements. You put in some better visualization and you change the colors, but you don't really change the fundamental underlying nature of the app. I've worked with teams that did that 3 times before they called me, and the users kept rejecting because they said, why change? There isn't enough to justify the change. It actually is easier to get the users on your side if you go big. Talk about that in just a minute. Also, it's hard to learn to let go of ideas that don't fit. You will inevitably come up with ideas, and some people have kind of an emotional attachment to their ideas. So understand that what you're trying to do is pour in lots and lots of ideas, and a lot of them get rejected. Only the best ideas survive. If you go in with the idea that, boy, my idea is so good, it's going to get to the end of that funnel, you are not a productive member of a design team. You just have to learn to let go of the ideas that you come up with. And maybe the most common mistake that I see teams make in their process, because this is, again, based on what people tend to do in the past, is the single prototype or design. Most teams do a prototype, meaning just one. But think about that. You go to the user with this single choice. Well, it's not a choice, really, is it? It's not a choice if there's just one. What kind of feedback can they give you? Well, most commonly, it breaks down into a food fight over stupid things. Where things are on the screen and what colors and what order. How many of you have sat through those food fights? Here's the way you avoid the food fights. You have multiple choices for the user to evaluate. And now they are engaged at a much higher level to understand what those choices will do for them, which one best matches their workflow. Oh, let me tell you one of the best things about this that you wouldn't necessarily anticipate, but I figured this out about 4 years ago. So when you get involved in this process, there's always somebody, it seems, in a big enough organization, there's somebody, manager or business analyst, and you start, and he comes to you and says, well, I've done the design. Here are the screens. You familiar with this one? Now, what happens in that situation? I mean, he's typically got, especially if he's a manager, he's got a fair amount of power, so now the team doesn't really want to tell him, I'm sorry, that sucks. Nobody wants to tell him that. That's the beauty of the experimental approach. What I say to the guy is, well, that looks like an interesting approach. We'll put that in as one of them, and we'll have three or four more. What's he going to say to that? See, at that point, he can't say, no, I know mine is so good, you can't do any more. That looks arrogant, and he knows it. So nobody has ever come to me and said, no, mine is so good, you can't do any more. They don't like it, but they don't know what to say. So they just let you go along with it. And now you get to put all of the examples in front of the users. You prototype them out. And of course, if his is sucks as bad as you think it will, then, and you don't tell who produced what to the users. Oh, no, no, no. You let them choose, and he just has to accept their judgment. They're the users. As I said, those kind of control freaks don't like it when you do it, but they have no recourse. They have no obvious way to block you. So this is kind of some of the political implications of getting to this transition to modern apps that I've learned over time. I talked a little bit about this. The second most common mistake is timidity. When you're entering the modern apps world, you need to create a big gap between where they are now and where they will be. Because if you don't, then they will want to snap right back to what they're used to. You have to give them something obviously, compellingly better than what they have now. That means you have to be bold and forward-thinking. As Goethe was said to have remarked, boldness has beauty and magic in it. Be bold in your designs. You'd be surprised how often the boldness is what gets you to that of course moment. That you come up with a bold design that's really different, but after tweaking it a little bit, you end up with something that the user says, yes. Once you reach that of course moment, they have completely forgotten about what came before. I will tell you a real story from a real client. They had old Visual Basic software from the 90s. They had tried 3 times in the .NET era to replace it. The Windows Forms version never got complete acceptance. And the users had a lot of power over it. WPF, two trials. Neither got accepted by the users. And the development staff was, they were pretty beat down. Because, I mean, they've done hard work, but what they've done with their WPF designs is twiddle around the edges. Tons and tons of data grids. Because that's what everybody said they wanted. That's what they were used to. But what that meant was, now, they're not going to get away from VB6. Do you realize how fast VB6 is on modern computers? Oh, man, is it fast. So it's got some built-in advantages, and they couldn't overcome them with modern apps, with modern technology stacks. So I got called in, and we went back to a blank paper design, completely threw out everything they'd ever done in design, came up with entirely new approaches. 6 months later, they rolled out their first version based on that. Well, actually, after 4 months, they took it to some of the branches. The first 3 branches they took it to said, could we be the pilot project for this? Because they had achieved, of course. They had achieved that level where the user said, man, that's just a better way of doing it. That fits my job. And in a very shockingly little period of time, less than a year from the moment I walked in, the entire Fortune 1000 company had moved to the new system. They obliterated user resistance. You have to be bold. If you're going to play in this space, if you're going to survive in this new ecosystem in the modern apps world, you have to be bold. You have to break your connection to the past and come up with designs that you never thought you could. But I will tell you, once you go through it once you have gone through a design process and produced work that good, you will probably never go back to what you were doing before because it'll be too painful. So, how do you learn design process? Well, as I said, there's a lot of variability. One of the best places to start is this book, Sketching User Experiences, the Workbook, based on a book by Bill Buxton and with some other people contributing. It's very much a workbook that kind of guides you through some of the things that you can do at various stages. And I recommend that as a good way to start learning design process. But there, especially if you've got large teams and you've got political stuff going on, on-site consultation can help. If you can get somebody to go through your first design process, every team I've ever worked with doesn't need me after that. Once I get them through the first one and they learn how to design much, much better stuff, then I go back and, man, they're producing amazing stuff on their own. Every team I've ever worked with was like that. I did have to drag one of them. I had to slap them around a bit. Because they were so devoted to those data grids. They could not get it out of their mind that their interface was going to be a data grid. They just couldn't. And so I finally showed them enough things. I got them excited, and they caught the spark. And then they took their non-data grid designs to the users, and what did they get? They got, of course, the users really liked the new non-data grid designs because they were obviously better. So, on-site consultation. There are some on-site design classes that include process, so you can look at those. And basically, there's my contact information. We have about 3 minutes or so for questions. Please use the microphones if you have questions. Okay, who's first? Right here?
How does what you're talking about apply when you're in an environment where you have almost everybody has two monitors? How would you approach, what paradigms would you do to kind of address that?
Well, that's a good question. And understand that when I talk about modern apps, I don't necessarily mean just apps that work in Windows 8 and iOS. There are examples of WPF apps, and in fact, the one I talked to you about. Those would be considered modern apps. But when we write application shells now, invariably one of the things we include is tear-off capability, just like Visual Studio, so that there is the ability to transport whatever piece of the app they want over to another monitor for their use. Now, we find that 80% of the users don't need to do that, but the power users do. That's what those extra monitors are for. And so WPF is absolutely fine for that. Look, I like Windows 8 for mobile stuff. I think it's a fine platform for that. As I said, I think it's better than some of the other technology out there. But for desktop stuff, WPF is hard to beat. It's an excellent technology, not used as much as it should be. We got anybody else? Sketching user experiences. Got it? Last chance? Okay, folks. Hope this was helpful. I will be here. I have business cards. Anybody that wants to, please come up and get a business card and ask questions as need be.